December 17th, 1967. The skeletal remains of an unidentified male are found in Balsam Lake Provincial Park, near Cobequenque, Ontario, Canada. 5 months later, the decomposing body of another unidentified male is discovered in a field near the village of Schomburg, and the similarities between the two scenes suggest that both victims were murdered by the same killer. The victims go unidentified for 40 years, until clay busts of their heads are constructed and shown on television. They are eventually identified as Richard Dickey Hovey and Eric Jones, but the identity of their killer remains unknown. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and since we just passed Victoria Day here in Canada, I thought it only appropriate to venture back to my home country and cover a Canadian mystery this week, the murders of Richard Dickey Hovey and Eric Jones. As you may or may not know, The Trail Went Cold is a Canadian-produced podcast, but thus far, we have only covered two Canadian mysteries, the Blind River Rest Stop murders and the death of Cindy James. And those were both released quite some time ago, so it's about time we return to the Great White North. Today's story is quite an interesting one, because it involves two murdered John Does who went unidentified for 40 years until their cases were resurrected and clay busts of the victims' heads were constructed. The busts were shown on television, and miraculously, both victims were recognized by their surviving family members. However, even though they both got their identities back, this story is still a mystery since we don't actually know who murdered them, though the evidence does suggest that they were both victims of the same serial killer. One of the reasons I decided to select this story is because one of the victims was found near the village of Schomburg, Ontario, which is only about a half hour away from my original hometown of Orangeville. I have probably driven through Schomburg hundreds of times on Highway 9, and I had no idea it was connected to an unsolved mystery until I read about this story in an excellent book called Unsolved True Canadian Cold Cases, written by Robert J. Hachowski. Anyway, before we get started, just a brief reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which alternates between our regular full-length episodes and shorter mini-sodes. We deliver either a new full-length episode or a new mini-sode every Wednesday. We're currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music, so if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it. The Trail Went Cold also has its own PayPal account and a donate button on the website. If there's anyone out there who wants to make a donation, it would be greatly appreciated, and we'll be sure to give you a shout-out on a future episode. In keeping with today's Canadian theme, I need to provide a plug for some of the other excellent Canadian true crime podcasts out there. Of course, there's Someone Knows Something and Missing and Murdered, Who Killed Alberta Williams, which are both multi-part podcasts produced by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. There's also the Nighttime Podcast by Jordan Bonaparte, which covers mysteries and crimes from Atlantic Canada. And there are two fairly new Canadian-produced true crime podcasts from folks I've met in the Podcast We Listen To Facebook group. They are Canadian True Crime Podcast by Christy Lee, and The Minds of Madness by Tyler Allen. Be sure to check out all these podcasts, as they're all terrific, and they also happen to have way more Canadian content than I do. Now, starting today, we are going to be thanking all of our new donors during the conclusion of our episodes, rather than the introduction, so stick around for that. And we also want you to stick around to the very end, because we are going to be making a very special announcement. Another cold case featured on The Trail Went Cold has just been solved. And appropriately enough, much like the story in today's episode, it involves the long-awaited identification of an unknown decedent. So stay tuned for that. So with all that out of the way, let us now venture up north to profile the unsolved murders of Dickie Hovey and Eric Jones. Our story begins in South Central Ontario in 1967. On December 17th of that year, a hunter discovered some skeletal remains in a wooded area in Balsam Lake Provincial Park, located near the community of Coboconk. The victim appeared to be male, and even though the exact cause of death could not be determined, the evidence suggested murder. His hands and wrist bones were knotted together by an 11-foot length of twine. He carried no identification, and no clothing could be found at the scene at all, except for a pair of white tennis shoes, so it seemed like his murder was sexual in nature. Unfortunately, investigators had virtually nothing to go on, and they could not even identify the victim, let alone figure out who murdered him. Forensic tests determined that he was likely between 15 to 18 years old, around 5'3", and that he had been killed approximately 6 months before he was discovered. His most unique and distinguishing characteristic was the fact that he had a 13th vertebra and a 13th rib on his right side rather than the usual 12. Without an identity, he simply became known as the Balsam Lake John Doe, but there would be an interesting development 5 months later. On May 15, 1968, a farmer plowing his field discovered the skeletal remains of a young man near the village of Schomburg, which is located 40 kilometers north of Toronto and nearly 130 kilometers away from Coboconk. In spite of the distance between them, there was enough to suggest the two victims might be connected. Like the first victim, this young man appeared to be in his late teens and around 5.5 feet tall. He was found with his hands tied behind his back, this time with a shoelace. The victim was also nude, and there was no clothing to be found at the scene at all, suggesting another sexually motivated crime. These similarities caused speculation that both men might have been murdered by a serial killer. Neither of them could be identified, so the investigation pretty much went nowhere, and the victim's remains were put into boxes and left unclaimed on a shelf in the coroner's office. It's possible that both of these cases might have faded into obscurity forever if the Ontario Provincial Police hadn't decided to launch a new website 4 decades later. This website was called the OPP Resolve Initiative, and hundreds of cold cases involving missing persons and unidentified remains were added to it. The OPP felt motivated to revisit a lot of these cases, and in particular, the two unidentified John Does who were found in 1967 and 68 seemed to capture their attention. So they decided to commission the services of Master Corporal Peter Thompson, a major crimes investigator with the Canadian Forces National Investigation Services. Thompson also happened to be a very talented forensic artist who had been trained at the FBI's Academy in Quantico. He could painstakingly apply clay to the skulls of deceased victims in order to create 3-dimensional clay model busts of their heads, providing an accurate representation of what their faces would have looked like. In November of 2006, the OPP held a press conference and put these clay busts of the two victims' heads on display. They asked anyone watching to come forward if they thought they recognized either of these John Does. Well, remarkably, within 24 hours of the press conference, police received a very promising lead. More than one person phoned their tip line who thought they recognized the Schomburg John Doe as a missing young man named Richard Hovey, who commonly went by the name Dickie. Dickie hailed from Fredericton, New Brunswick, and was born on May 14, 1950. So coincidentally, the date the Schomburg victim was discovered just happened to be the day after what would have been Dickie's 18th birthday. Dickie was an aspiring guitar player who decided to leave home at age 17 and hitchhike from Fredericton to Toronto in order to pursue a music career. Dickie was particularly attracted by Toronto's Yorkville district, which was a musical hotspot during the 1960s. Some of the most famous Canadian musicians of all time played in Yorkville during this time period, including Neil Young, Gordon Lightfoot, and Joni Mitchell. Dickie had ventured there in 1967, hoping to find his big break. He got a fairly regular gig playing at a local coffee house, but unfortunately, he just kind of faded from sight. After not receiving any letters or phone calls from him for months, Dickie's parents reported his disappearance to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, but since law enforcement in general wasn't so great at investigating the disappearance of teens and young adults back then, they never bothered to file a missing persons report. And that was pretty much that, as Dickie's family never heard a thing about him for nearly 40 years. By 2006, both of Dickie's parents had passed away, but he still had enough surviving relatives and friends who watched the OPP's press conference and thought Dickie bore a striking resemblance to one of the clay busts. So investigators traveled to New Brunswick in order to obtain blood samples from Dickie's family members, and amazingly, they turned out to be a perfect match to the victim's DNA. Only 1 month after the press conference, the Schomburg John Doe was conclusively identified as Dickie Hovey. There were still no answers about the identity of the Balsam Lake John Doe, but that mystery would eventually have its own resolution. In February of 2009, the Canadian news magazine show W5 decided to air a segment about Dickie Hovey's story, and the clay bust of the Balsam Lake John Doe's head was put on display again. Well, a woman named Pauline LaTendresse happened to watch this show, and she thought the victim resembled her brother, Eric Jones, whom she had not seen in over 40 years. Eric was originally born in Knowlville, a community located in northeastern Ontario next to the city of Sudbury. Eric was one of 11 children in his family, and in 1967, at the age of 18, he decided to quit school and move to Toronto, where he stayed with one of his aunts and worked as a dishwasher. The last time anyone from Eric's family saw him was in April of that year, when he returned home to Knowlville to attend the wedding of one of his sisters. Eric then went back to Toronto, but continuously wrote letters back and forth with his sister Pauline. However, at some point, Pauline mailed a letter to Eric, which was returned to her marked "No such address." It turned out that the aunt Eric had been staying with had moved from Toronto to Montreal. When the family contacted this aunt, she claimed to have no idea where Eric was, and pretty much just said, "Oh, I thought he just moved back to Knowlville." Eric's family tried to report him missing, but once again, since this was the 1960s and Eric was 18 years old, the police pretty much blew them off. The last time Eric had spoken to his family at his sister's wedding, there was a major disagreement over his decision to drop out of school, so the police figured that Eric probably just went off somewhere on his own and didn't want to contact his family anymore. The Joneses never believed that, but there really wasn't anything they could do, so they were left wondering what happened to Eric for the next 4 decades, until Pauline just happened to tune into W5 one night and recognized Eric's face on a clay bust. After Pauline contacted the OPP, they came by to collect her DNA, and it wasn't long before it was matched to the Balsam Lake John Doe, and he was positively identified as Eric Jones. So it was nice that Dickie and Eric's families finally received answers after 4 decades, as both men got their identities back and received a proper burial. However, this didn't change the fact that they were both murder victims, and the same perpetrator was likely responsible for their deaths. Even though the OPP reopened the investigation into their cases and offered a $50,000 reward for information leading to an arrest, the circumstances behind the deaths of Dickie Hovey and Eric Jones are still unknown, as is the identity of their killer. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So even though both these murders are still technically unsolved, this is still a pretty remarkable and inspiring story in many ways, though it's frustrating in others. One of the most amazing developments in cold case investigations in recent years is the amount of resolutions for cases involving unidentified decedents. I've talked about this subject on previous episodes, but the internet has proven to be an incredibly valuable tool in helping unidentified John and Jane Does get their names back. Many of these cases, someone will see a composite sketch or a forensic reconstruction of an unidentified victim and notice that they resemble a family member, friend, or acquaintance they haven't heard from in quite some time. And their hunch sometimes turns out to be correct, as in the cases of Dickie Hovey and Eric Jones. Both men's families probably had no hope of ever finding out what happened to them until they turned on the TV and suddenly saw those clay busts of unidentified murder victims who looked just like Dickie and Eric. However, the frustrating part of this story is the circumstances of their disappearances. A recurring theme I've noticed in stories where decedents are identified after several decades is that the victim will leave home, travel a great distance, and then suddenly stop communicating with their loved ones. These stories often took place long before the internet or cell phones, so the only way the victim's family senses that something's wrong is when they just stop hearing from them after a while. And it's really difficult to file a missing persons report because you can't pinpoint an exact time or place where the victim disappeared. Not to mention that law enforcement often had a very lackadaisical attitude towards the disappearances of young people back then. So if there wasn't any hard evidence pointing to an abduction or foul play, they'd often just write the victims off as runaways. So I can't imagine how frustrating it must have been for Dickie and Eric's families to just lose track of them and not have any idea whatsoever what might have happened. But since the investigations into these cases were reopened, there have been some pretty interesting leads, and these murders might be a lot more solvable than you think. However, let's take a moment to talk about another case involving an unidentified victim, which might be connected to this story. On the evening of July 16, 1980, a motorist pulled over on a rural road near Markham, Ontario. He walked about 75 feet into the woods to relieve himself, and wound up stumbling onto some skeletal remains. The police were notified, and forensic testing revealed that the remains belonged to a white male between the ages of 25 and 40, who was around 5.5 feet tall. It seemed likely that the remains were in the woods at least 2 years before they were discovered. Now, the thing which really threw investigators for a loop was that even though the victim was male, there were a bunch of different pieces of women's clothing discovered nearby, including a red blouse, women's blue jeans, and a pair of red and pink high-heeled shoes. A woman's powder compact was also found. So assuming that the clothing belonged to the victim, the logical explanation seemed to be that they were transgendered or a crossdresser. But remember, this was 1980, and the world wasn't quite as progressive about this subject back then, so that might explain why the investigation into this person's death was not handled particularly well. While the exact cause of death could not be determined, the original coroner's report seemed to imply that the victim may have been struck by a car in a possible hit-and-run accident. Yes, that's right. A hit-and-run accident which somehow managed to propel the victim 75 feet into the woods and knock every piece of clothing off their body. Completely logical. And while the remains of Dickie Hovey and Eric Jones were stored in boxes in the coroner's office, the remains of this particular victim were buried in a pauper's grave. But the real unusual part was that they decided to bury the victim 3 years after they were originally found, and the women's clothing was also buried in the grave alongside the remains, which, needless to say, is not exactly proper procedure for unresolved cases involving unidentified decedents. Well, it seems like the success the OPP had with identifying Dickie Hovey inspired them to revisit this case. In 2007, the remains of the Markham victim were exhumed. DNA was extracted, and another clay model bust was made of the victim's head, providing a reconstruction of what their face looked like. At one point, investigators got a very promising lead when they attempted to link the victim with a gay Montreal man who had disappeared in 1978, but when their DNA was compared with a blood sample from the missing man's family, they did not match. So thus far, the Markham victim continues to remain unidentified. While on the surface, there doesn't seem to be that much to connect this particular victim to Dickie Hovey or Eric Jones, particularly since they were discovered over a decade later. But there is a decent possibility that all three of these people were murdered by the same person. When the investigation into Dickie's case was reopened in 2006, the OPP uncovered information that Dickie was seen getting into a light blue Corvair in the Yorkville district of Toronto sometime in June of 1967, and a muscular black man was driving the vehicle. This appears to be the last known sighting of Dickie, and this black man fits the description of a very strong suspect. His name is James Henry Greenidge, and while I'm sure most of you have never heard of him, he is considered by some to be Canada's first known serial killer. Greenidge had a very tumultuous childhood, and was working the streets as a male prostitute by age 16. His criminal record began in 1955 at age 18, when he received a 10-year prison sentence for raping and beating a 14-year-old girl in Toronto, whom he pretty much selected at random while she was walking down the street. In 1965, Greenidge was sentenced to 6 months in a reformatory for beating and strangling a man whom he believed was responsible for sending him to prison. Greenidge probably would have killed him if witnesses hadn't called the police, and it turned out that Greenidge had mistakenly attacked the wrong guy. Well, in 1967, downtown Toronto was terrorized by a serial sexual predator who targeted gay men. He would pick them up and take them out into remote areas outside the city before violently attacking them, stripping them of their clothing, and leaving them for dead. Of course, this predator turned out to be James Henry Greenidge, and there are two known victims who can officially be tied to him. In July of that year, Greenidge picked up a 21-year-old gay man named William Howell in a Toronto movie theater. They drove out to a remote road located near the city of Barrie, but when Howell asked Greenidge to pay him $20 for sex, that seemed to set Greenidge off into a violent rage. He proceeded to beat and stab Howell before slitting his throat, tying him up, and stripping him naked. Howell was left for dead in a field, but in spite of his injuries, he managed to get up and walk a mile before collapsing, but thankfully, a farmer found him and called for help. Howell received emergency surgery at a local hospital to save his life, and he was able to identify his attacker. That same month, the new decomposing body of a missing 17-year-old Toronto man named Robert Wayne Mortimer was found in a remote field near Markham. When Greenidge was arrested for his attack on William Howell, he was tied to the Mortimer murder when a piece of Mortimer's birth certificate was found in his car. Since they couldn't determine Mortimer's exact cause of death, Greenidge was charged with manslaughter. He was also charged with attempted murder for attacking Howell, and at trial, he claimed that his motive was guilt over being with a male prostitute. Greenidge wound up serving 10 years in prison for these crimes. After his release, he changed his name to James Gordon Henry and moved to Winnipeg. Well, sure enough, it wasn't long before Greenidge slash Henry got into trouble again. In 1980, he lured a 13-year-old boy to his home and gave him some tea laced with a drug which caused him to pass out. When the boy woke up, Henry was sexually assaulting him and strangling him with a blanket, but he managed to break free, escape, and inform the police. For reasons unknown, the charges against Henry were stayed, and it wasn't too long before he committed another murder. His last known crime occurred in 1981, when he picked up a 24-year-old prostitute named Elizabeth Fells in Vancouver. Once again, he took the victim out into a remote area before he flew into a rage, raping Fells, stabbing her multiple times, slashing her throat, and leaving her for dead. Fells initially survived the attack and managed to make it to the road and flag down a passing car. She identified Henry as her attacker, but unfortunately, succumbed to her injuries 8 days later. Henry was charged with her murder, and this time, he didn't get off easy for his crimes. He received a life sentence and has been locked up ever since. Henry is now 80 years old and currently incarcerated at Mountain Institution in Agassiz, British Columbia. It's believed that Henry slash Greenidge is responsible for more crimes than he's been charged with, and from what you've heard, I'm sure you can see numerous similarities between his MO and the murders of Dickie Hovey and Eric Jones. The last known sighting of Dickie was him climbing into a light blue Corvair in Yorkville, driven by a black man matching Greenidge's description. When Greenidge picked up William Howell and attacked him, he was driving a light-colored Corvair. Considering that at least two young men were picked up by Greenidge in downtown Toronto during the summer of 1967 and taken to remote areas outside the city to be attacked, I really don't see how there's any other logical explanation besides Greenidge being Dickie Hovey's killer. Now, there isn't any definitive evidence tying Greenidge to Eric Jones's murder, but it's worth noting that Eric's aunt's house, the place he was staying at that summer, was located only 5 blocks from the location where Dickie was seen climbing into the Corvair. And given how similar Eric's murder was to the attacks on Dickie Hovey, William Howell, and Robert Wayne Mortimer, it seems pretty likely that Greenidge killed him too. You can see a pattern here, as Greenidge never committed any of his murders in Toronto, as he always made sure to drive his victims to different locations outside the city. If William Howell hadn't survived his attack and identified Greenwich, who knows how much longer Greenwich would have been able to keep this up, and how many more victims there would have been. Since Greenwich's two known victims from this time period were gay males, you could easily assume that Dickie and Eric were gay as well. We really don't know too much about their personal lives, so I'm not going to make any assumptions about their sexuality. Greenwich is unique in that he would target both males and females, as we know he was responsible for the murder of one woman and the rape of at least one other. However, Greenwich's predilection for attacking gay men has led to speculation that he was responsible for the death of the unidentified victim found near Markham in 1980. There were a lot of similar circumstances to Greenwich's other crimes, as the victim was likely gay or transgendered, and they were found nude in a remote area, though, admittedly, their clothing was found nearby, and Greenwich usually didn't leave his victim's clothing at the murder scenes. But it's certainly possible he could have done this. The victim was found near Markham, where Greenwich had already killed Robert Wayne Mortimer. It seems likely they were murdered in 1978, which would have coincided with the time period when Greenwich was released from prison. And during the last year of his sentence, Greenwich was transferred to a minimum security institution in Toronto and granted weekend passes. His whereabouts on most of these weekends are unaccounted for, so it's possible he could have committed more attacks, including on the victim found near Markham. Given the vicious nature of Greenwich's crimes, it's clear that the system treated him way too leniently for way too long. Now, surprisingly, ever since he was convicted in 1981, Greenwich, or James Gordon Henry as he's now called these days, has apparently been the ultimate model prisoner. He gets along well with staff, he goes out of his way to help fellow inmates, and he's completed the intensive sexual offender program. If Henry has reformed, maybe now that he's nearing the end of his life, he'll finally bring an end to this mystery by confessing to the murders of Dickie Hovey and Eric Jones, right? Well, I wouldn't bet on it. Until very recently, Canadian sentencing laws allowed even the very worst criminals to get an opportunity at parole. Even if they received a life sentence, like Henry did, they would still be eligible to receive a parole hearing after serving 25 years. Henry did indeed get his first parole hearing after 25 years, but in spite of his model behavior on the inside, he was rejected. He's been up in front of the parole board a few times since then, most recently in 2014, but he's been denied each time. I'd say it's very unlikely Henry ever gets paroled, but as there's still a slight chance, I doubt he'll ever confess to additional crimes he committed, such as the murders of Dickie Hovey and Eric Jones. And no matter how good his behavior might have been within the past few decades, Henry is still clearly a remorseless psychopath. Each time he got released from prison, he just went on to commit more vicious crimes. Like I said earlier, this guy might be Canada's first real serial killer, so he deserves to be locked up for the rest of his life. I guess you could consider this to be one of those mysteries where the case is still officially open, but for all intents and purposes, it's probably solved. When you look at the circumstances, I think I can say with at least 99.9% certainty that James Henry Greenwich was the killer of Dickie Hovey. And given how similar their deaths were, I'd say it's very likely that Greenwich is also the murderer of Eric Jones. I'm on the fence about Greenwich being responsible for the death of the unidentified Markham victim, as there's no hard evidence to tie him to the crime. But I would not be surprised at all if he's the perpetrator. And who knows? Greenwich may be responsible for other unsolved murders we don't even know about. However, even if all these murders are never officially pinned on Greenwich, at least we can take comfort in knowing that he'll never harm anyone else. Before I bring this podcast to a close, I should offer many words of praise for the Ontario Provincial Police and the Resolve Initiative. At times, I know I must sound overly critical about law enforcement's, since there have been some unsolved cases on this podcast where police did drop the ball. But they came through in a big way here. Sure, the disappearances of Dickie Hovey and Eric Jones could have been handled better back when they originally happened, but I give the OPP all the credit in the world for bringing these 40-year-old cold cases back into the spotlight. Peter Thompson did an amazing job when he created those clay model busts of Dickie and Eric's heads, and it's quite a miracle that his efforts paid off, and both men were identified after 4 decades. All we really need to close the books on them for good is definitively proving who killed them. It seems very likely it was James Henry Greenwich / James Gordon Henry, but it would be nice if we had conclusive evidence to prove it. So if you have any information on the murders of Dickie Hovey and Eric Jones, or if you have info about the true identity of the victim found near Markham in 1980, please contact the Ontario Provincial Police. If you're calling from Canada, the number is 1-877-934-6363. 1-877-934-6363. But if you do not reside in Canada and you have information, the number is 1-705-330-4144. 1-705-330-4144. And if you just have your own thoughts about any of these cases, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Anyway, like I mentioned in the intro, I am pleased to announce that for the second time in a month, a cold case featured on The Trail Went Cold has been solved. As you probably heard, an arrest was made in the disappearance of Pamela Butler last month, but this month, an unidentified Jane Doe has finally got her name back. Back in January, we released a minisode about the 1984 disappearance of Jonelle Matthews and discussed a theory that Jonelle might be an unidentified young woman who was killed after being hit by two vehicles on Pacific Coast Highway in Huntington Beach, California on April 1, 1990. The woman had claimed her name was Andrea and had told at least one person she was from Virginia, but after her death, she could not be positively identified and simply became known as the Huntington Beach Jane Doe. Well, it turned out the victim wasn't Jonelle Matthews, but just a few weeks ago, it was officially confirmed that the Huntington Beach Jane Doe was identified as 26-year-old Andrea Kuiper, who originally hailed from Fairfax, Virginia. It turned out that Andrea's family had not seen her since she left Virginia in 1990 in order to travel to California. Unfortunately, Andrea had a history of mental health issues and had struggled with manic depressive disorder and drug addiction, so her family had no idea what happened to her. It actually sounds pretty similar to how Dickie Hovey and Eric Jones disappeared, as Andrea's family simply lost touch and stopped hearing from her. Well, in early 2017, the National Missing Persons and Unidentified Persons System teamed up with the FBI for a project which involved comparing the fingerprints of unidentified decedents with fingerprints from the FBI's database. Remarkably, they got a hit on the Huntington Beach Jane Doe, which matched Andrea Kuiper, whose prints were on file because she had been hired to work for the U.S. Department of Agriculture back in 1987. So The Trail Went Cold would like to express our deepest condolences to Andrea Kuiper's family, but we're very happy that they have finally attained closure and that Andrea has gotten her identity back. So thus far, that is two cases from our podcast which have been solved, and hopefully, there are many more to come. So now I want to take this opportunity to give a shout out to our newest donors this week, who are Sean, Jan, and Kara. So thank you very much, guys. And I also want to remind everyone that it is now only 2 weeks until I will be appearing at CrimeCon at the JW Marriott Hotel in Indianapolis from June 9th to the 11th and representing The Trail Went Cold on Podcast Row. If you still haven't ordered tickets yet but want to attend, there is still time to use our special promo code to get yourself a 20% discount. And if you've already used our special Trail Went Cold promo code to purchase tickets, or you're planning to use it, you are automatically invited to attend a special private party being held for us by CrimeCon. And I've got some special surprises in store. It's being held on Friday, June 9th from 6 until 7 p.m. And if you use the promo code, they automatically have your name on the guest list. So if you still want to order tickets and ensure yourself a spot, our special promo code for a 20% discount is TTWC20. That's TTWC20. I wish I could also invite every single one of you listeners who didn't use the promo code to this party, but unfortunately, space is limited. But not to worry, I am planning a special reward for each and every one of you listeners who comes to meet me on Podcast Row, so stay tuned for more details. I really can't wait to meet you all, and I hope to see you there. So I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters from the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thank you to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. And like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website, so if you want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put into this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new minisode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm sorry.